Good afternoon, Mad River Valley. This is Jerry with the 4-H show, Health, Harmony, Happiness, and Humor. Today, I don't know what we're going to go with. Maybe all four combined. But I was not here last week because I was in New Hampshire. I went to St. Anselm's College, the Institute of Politics, which is a division of St. Anselm's College, because there was an extremely important speaker there. I'm just absolutely thrilled that I got not only to hear, but to meet, shake his hand, and he autographed my book. And he's been one of my heroes for over 40 years because I started with his environmental work, and I grew up on the Delaware River, and his stomping grounds was New York and the Hudson, but the work that he did cleaning up the Hudson River overflowed to the Delaware and that whole area, and he's really the key person responsible for cleaning up rivers, I believe, across the country, but anyway, certainly the one that I grew up on. And I just love him, and that has segued into his work with health. And this speech is probably one of the most moving, poignant speeches I've ever heard in my life. I do want to say that he has an affliction with his voice. It's called spasmodic dysphonia. So his voice is scratchy. It's worse in the beginning, and as he goes along, it gets better. But please try and persevere through it, because it does get better. And the most, I think, important information that he gives out in his speech is about at 25 minutes. But I also want to say that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the founder, chairman, and chief litigation counsel for Children's Health Defense. Here in New England, it's Children's Health Defense. It's new, www.childrenshealthdefense.org. And they were he was invited to speak at the Institute of Politics, mostly because of what's going on with the primary for the Democratic Party. They're moving the primary from New Hampshire. I can't even remember the exact state they're moving it to, but and the New Hampshire Democratic coalition is trying to keep it there. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. came to speak to explain why it should be kept in New Hampshire. And he gave some really good talking points and some great reasons. And he also discussed the DNC's rules for the 2024 presidential nominating calendar regarding the primary and the First Amendment and some core issues that are important to Children's Health Defense. And please note that Mr. Kennedy's personal endeavors and his political opinions are entirely separate from his work with Children's Health Defense and their mission. And also, this program presents the views of its participants and producers, as it does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its licensed holder, RootsWork. I'm sorry, our technical difficulties got me a little off balance with responsibilities here. I also want to say we are WMRW 94.5 FM and streaming at WMRW.org. This speech is a little over an hour, so we may run over a little bit from my 1 o'clock time slot, but you can, if for some reason you cannot listen to the whole thing, please go to Spinatron. It's the Spinatron link on the WMRW.org website, and you can click on, put in 12:15 probably at this point, and put in today's date, and then you can get the speech up that way for 2 weeks after today. And it's really, regardless of where you're coming from with the various issues that are in front of us and dividing us, I think the most helpful thing we can all do is listen to each other. And so I just hope everybody gets to listen to this speech. And it'll take me 1 second to get it up here. And thank you for listening. Okay, I'm back. I'm going to turn you over to Hal for a minute because the sound went off and I just need to get it back. And that might take me a minute or two. So enjoy the music meanwhile. Had I known you better than before. Had I known you better. Okay, we're on.
Growing bushes. I want to read that.
Wonderful event here today in New Hampshire School of Politics at St. Anselm College. My name is Neil Levesque, and I'm the director here of the Institute. You can see all of your friends here and all your friends against the wall. This is a place where national politics and history is made every single day. So today is no different. We're very, very excited about who will be here and speaking to you all. Just a couple quick things. Former Senate President Donna Susie, an alum of St. Anselm College, is here today. Speaker Shurtleff, who is the Speaker Emeritus at this point, an honorary degree. And our chairman of our Democratic Party, Ray Buckley, who are all here today. Give a little round of applause. When I introduce someone, I go on the internet like everyone else. I start going through, and the biographies are usually, you know, pretty long, but this one is long. And so I'm going to tighten it up and just say a few things about our speaker here. Robert Kennedy Jr. Lives in LA, and he came all the way here today. He went to Harvard University for his undergrad and then to the University of Virginia, where he got his Juris Doctor. He was a senior attorney for many years at the Natural Resource Defense Council. He's the founders of Water Keepers Alliance. He's written 10 books, or edited 10 books, written or edited 10 books, including two on the New York Times bestseller list, two of which are on your table here. One of the interesting things about one of the chapters is he's also a master falconer. So all the chapter on that is a rather interesting subject. But most importantly, I think, is that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a champion of the New Hampshire presidential primary. And the reason is our primary is really about democracy, and it's not just good for New Hampshire and the Democrats here. It's good for America that candidates get tested, they get the questions, and they get the follow-up questions. That is good for us. And so we are very pleased about the fact that he came here today. He was here in 1980 working for his uncle got a lot of experience here in New Hampshire. One final thing, and the most important thing, you know, we make decisions in our life, and we know that our speaker here made a great decision. His wife, Cheryl Hines, is here today as well. You might recognize her. We're very happy to have you here.
Joseph Kennedy funded, probably really created a Democratic primary in its modern form in this state in 1959 in preparation for my uncle's run. That was a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing it with me. Lou DeSandro, I don't think he's here, but if I saw him outside, and that was a thrill. And then Donna Susie, thank you all for being great Democrats, and thanks for everything that you've done, devoted your lives to making, to the idealism of making this country live up to its highest ideals and making our democracy work for all Americans. I wrote that letter to the DNC because I was just dumbstruck by the optics of what was happening at this particular time in history, when we have probably the greatest polarization in our country that we've ever had since the Civil War. Really dangerous polarization, and we don't know which direction it's going to go in, but it ought to be a preoccupation of anybody who wants to lead this country. How do you bridge the gap, this growing gap between Americans, this very, very tribalistic gap, and the fulcrum of that conversation for the past 2 years has been on election integrity. You know, whether it's January 6th, but for the past two elections, 2016 and 2021, there are people in both parties who are not, who do not believe the results, for better or for worse, right or wrong. In 2001, we, you know, every Democrat believed we had an election stolen in our country. In 2004, I wrote an award-winning article for Rolling Stone about the theft of the 2004 election. So people have concerns about election integrity, and a larger concern that everything is being rigged. You know, that if you're a big shot, you can rig anything. And that if you're a little guy, or a little girl, a little woman, you don't have any say in what happens. And here we have the president of our party, President of the United States, and head of our party who feels like he needs to move this primary to a state where he can better control the outcome. And what does that say to people who really believe that they're alienating this country? As Neil pointed out, this state has played a critical role in choosing candidates. In every other state, you can have these kind of aerial bombardments by billionaires or by the party where they don't have to meet anybody, where they can just propagandize them and, you know, buy advertising or whatever, or do very big events. And this state vets candidates for the entire country. They have to come into this state and run like they're running for a school board or for a town hall, and they get the questions, and, you know, they'll go into a hair salon or a diner in Plymouth or a Keene or Nashua, and they'll have to face, you know, an 80-year-old woman who reads The Economist every week and drilling down on these kind of questions that they're not going to get from the New York Times, they're not going to get from CNN, and they have to do the follow-up questions. And, you know, it's a service in New Hampshire, and the open-mindedness of the people in this state where they genuinely do not make up their mind to the end. And they approach, it's a service that this state serves for the rest of the country. And it's just wrong to take it away from New Hampshire. 100 years, the primary has been held here, and it's just wrong. It just struck me as wrong and very, very bad optics for our country. I'm going to talk about how I kind of ended up here, but in the context of this polarization that's taking place, so I've spent a lot of my career, virtually all of my career, trying to figure out how to bridge the gap between Republicans and Democrats in this country. And when I knew I wanted to be an environmental attorney, but I also knew that I didn't want to work for some of the conventional environmental groups, which were basically kind of in a bubble, Democrats. And I wanted to really reach out to people, sort of hooking people and people who shared my values, but not my political party. People who understood, I think most Americans want a better lives for their children. They want to build communities that provide their children with the same opportunity for dignity and enrichment and prosperity and good health as the communities that our parents gave us. They want, there's no such thing as Republican children or Democratic children. We all want rich lives for our children. We want our country to be an exemplary nation. We want prosperity and safety. And that there ought to be a way to talk about those issues to people who are not in my political party. So I started my career and spent 40 years working for a blue-collar coalition of commercial and recreational fishermen on the Hudson River. We have on the Hudson the oldest commercial fishery in North America. It's 300 years old. The fishermen, many of the people that I've represented for decades, come from families that have been fishing the Hudson continuously since Dutch colonial times. It's a traditional gear fishery. They use the same fishing methods that were taught by the Algonquin Indians to the original Dutch settlers of New Amsterdam and then passed down through the generations. One of the enclaves of the commercial fishery on the Hudson is a little village called Crotonville, New York, which is 30 miles north of New York City on the east bank of the river. And the people who lived in Crotonville were not your prototypical affluent environmentalists. They were factory workers, carpenters, lathers, electricians. Half the people in Crotonville made their living, or at least some part of it, fishing or crabbing the Hudson. These were people who had little expectation that they'd ever go to Colorado or California or vacation with their families in the Rockies. For them, the environment was their backyard. It was their recreational values. It was their property values. It was their livelihoods and their food. In 1966, Penn Central Railroad began vomiting oil from a 4.5-foot pipe in the Groton-Rothman rail yard. And the oil went up the river on the tides and it blackened the beaches and made the shad taste of diesel so they couldn't be sold at the Fulton Fish Market in New York City. And all of the people in Crotonville came together in the only public building in the town in a room almost exactly this size. It was the Parker Vale American Legion Hall. This was a very patriotic community. Crotonville had one of the highest enlistment rates in World War II. Of any community in our country, and one of the highest mortality rates. And almost all of the original founders, board members, and officers of Riverkeeper were former Marines. They were combat veterans from World War II, from Korea, from Vietnam. They got together in that room, and they had been to the government agencies that are supposed to protect Americans from pollution. The Corps of Engineers, the Conservation Department, the Coast Guard, and they were given the bum's rush. They, after 20 separate visits to the Corps of Engineers office in Manhattan, two former Marines, combat veterans, Howard Glauca and Richie Garrett, who were the founders of the organization, the Corps of Engineers begging the Corps Colonel to do his job and shut down the Penn Central pipe. The Corps Colonel finally told them in exasperation, "These are important people. Speaking of the Penn Central Board of Directors, we can't treat them that way." But by this evening, in March of 1966, virtually everybody in Crotonville had come to the conclusion that government was in cahoots with the polluters, that these agencies had become captured by the industries they were supposed to regulate, and they were functioning as sock puppets for those industries. And they felt that the only way that they could reclaim the Hudson for themselves is if they confronted the polluters directly. And somebody suggested that they put a match to the oil slick coming out of the Penn Central pipe and burn up the pipe. Somebody else said they should roll a mattress up and jam it up the pipe and flood the rail yard with its own waste. Somebody else said that they should float a raft of dynamite into the intake of the Indian Point power plant, which at that time was killing a million fish a day on its intake screens and taking food off their family tables. And then a guy stood up, who was another combat veteran from Korea, a guy called Robert Boyle, who was for 65 years the outdoor editor of Sports Illustrated. He was a famous fly fisherman and spin fisherman. And 2 years earlier, he had written an article about angling in the Hudson for Sports Illustrated. And in researching that article, he came across an ancient navigational statute called the 1888 Rivers and Harbors Act. And that law said that it was illegal to pollute any waterway in the United States. You had to pay a big penalty if you got caught. But also, there was a bounty provision that said that anybody who turned in the polluter got to keep half the fine. And he took that law. Over to the libel lawyers at Time Inc., which owned Sports Illustrated, and he knew them. He said, "Is this still good law?" And they said, "It's still on the books, but it's never been enforced." And it was an 80-year-old law. And he said, "But you can still do it." And that evening, when all of these men and women, 300 people in Latin American Legion Hall, were talking about violence, he stood up in front of them with a copy of that law, and he said, "We shouldn't be talking about breaking the law, we should be talking about enforcing it." And they resolved that evening they were going to start a group that was then called the Hudson River Fishermen's Association, later became Riverkeeper, and they were going to go out, track down, and prosecute every polluter in the Hudson. 18 months later, they shut down the Penn Central pipe for good. They got to keep the first bounty in United States history under this 19th century statute. You got to keep $2,500, which was a huge amount of money, in Crotonville in 1968. There were 2 weeks of wild celebration in the town. And they used the money that was left over to go after C. McGahee, Tuck Tape, Standard Brand, American Cyanamid, the biggest corporations in America, and winning their cases. In 1973, they won a case against Anaconda Wire and Cable. They got the biggest penalty against a corporate polluter in American history, $200,000. They got to keep as a bounty. They used the money to build a boat. They began patrolling the river. They hired in 1983 using bounty money their first full-time riverkeeper, a commercial fisherman named John Cronin. He hired me as the attorney for the group, their first attorney, a year later. And I, during my time at Riverkeeper, brought over 300 successful lawsuits against Hudson River polluters. We forced polluters on the river to spend $3.5 billion remediating the Hudson. Today, the Hudson is an international model for ecosystem protection. This is a waterway that was, when I started working on it, was dead water, 20 miles north of New York City, 20 miles south of Albany. It caught fire. It turned colors, depending on what color they were painting the trucks at the GM plant, Tarrytown. And today, it's the richest waterway in the North Atlantic. It produces more pounds of fish per acre, more biomass per gallon than any other waterway in the Atlantic Ocean north of the equator. It's the last major river system left in the Atlantic Ocean that still has strong spawning stocks of all of its historical species of migratory fish. And the miraculous resurrection of the Hudson inspired the creation of river keepers all over the world. So we own the keeper name. We have 350 river keepers. Each one has a patrol boat. Each one as a full-time paid riverkeeper, and they litigate against polluters. It's a law enforcement organization. We are now the biggest water protection group in the world. A couple of things that I learned from them very quickly. One is, that from my years of working for the water keepers, that this mantra that you hear oftentimes on TV or from politicians and big polluters, that we have to choose between economic prosperity on the one hand and environmental protection on the other, is not true. Good environmental policy 100% of the time is identical to good economic policy. If we want to measure our economy, and this is how we ought to be measuring it, based upon how it produces jobs and the dignity of jobs over the long term, over the generation, and how it preserves the value of the assets of our community. If, on the other hand, we want to do what the big polluters are asking us to do, which is to treat the planet as if it were business in liquidation, convert our natural resources to cash as quickly as possible, have a few years of pollution-based prosperity, we can generate an instantaneous cash flow and the illusion of a prosperous economy, and we can make a few people into billionaires by impoverishing the rest of us. But our children are going to pay for our joyride, and they're going to pay for it with denuded landscapes and poor health and huge cleanup costs that are going to mount over time and that they're never going to be able to pay. Environmental injury is deficit spending. It's a way of loading the cost of our generation's prosperity onto the backs of our children. Now, one of the other things that I learned, the fishermen were not against free market capitalism. They were capitalists. They were business people. And they were descended from generations of business people. And their business plan was working for 300 years. It was flourishing. But they were being put out of business not because they had a bad business plan, but because somebody had corrupted our democracy. And they were being competed against by the General Electric Company, which was dumping PCBs into the river to avoid the cost of properly disposing of them, and had permission to do that from the New York State Conservation Department, because they were using political clout to escape the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay their production costs. And that's what all pollution is. It's a subsidy. If you want truth, you know, what we had was not free market capitalism. It was corporate crony capitalism. It's capitalism, it's socialism for the rich, and then this very savage, brutal capitalism for the poor. In a true free market promotes efficiency. And efficiency is the elimination of waste, and pollution is waste. In a true free market, we would be forced to properly value our natural resources. And it's the undervaluation of those resources that caused us to use them wastefully. In a true free market, you can't make yourself rich without making your neighbors rich and without enriching your community. But what polluters do is they make themselves rich by making everybody else poor. They raise standards of living for themselves and lowering quality of life for others, and by escaping the discipline of the free market and forcing by twisting and manipulating democracy, by capturing the agencies to escape, to evade the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay their production costs. That's what all pollution is. In 2005, I'm going to tell you how I got dragged kicking and screaming into the vaccine kind of morass. In 2005, well, let me go back 2 years earlier. The National Academy of Sciences completed a 10-year study that showed that every freshwater fish in North America, in all the provinces of Canada, all the states of the United States, had dangerous levels of mercury in their flesh. And that one out of every six American women, as a result, and mercury levels in their cord blood that endangered the lives of their placentas, of their unborn babies, and could result in a grim inventory of disease, including autism, blindness, mental retardation, heart, liver, kidney disease, etc. And that were sufficient to cause the guarantee at least one point permanent laws at one point, like you. One and six women. And it struck me then that we were living a science fiction nightmare. My children and the children of every other American would now no longer engage in the seminal primal activity of American youth, which is to go fishing with their father and mother in the local fishing hole and then come home and safely eat the fish. So we started suing the coal-burning power plants that were the sources of most of this mercury. Coal-burning power plants and cement kilns, those were the two biggest sources. Mining operations is the third. So we had different river keepers. There were lots of people suing coal plants back then, but for different reasons. The river keepers were all suing up for mercury. And we had about 40 cases at one point, and I was supervising them. And I was traveling around the United States and Canada. We were also working on legislation. And I was speaking at big groups, and I started noticing that almost every time I gave a large speech, these groups of women would come and sit in the front row. And they were always well-dressed. There were different people at every speech. And they would come early, they would get in the front row, and then they would wait till I was done, and then they would come up and talk to me. And as it turns out, they were all the mothers of intellectually disabled children who believed that the vaccines had injured their babies. And they would talk to me in kind of a very respectful but also vaguely scolding way, saying, if you're really interested in mercury exposures, you need to look at the vaccines because they dwarf what people are getting from the fish at that time. They've since replaced the mercury with aluminum, which is almost as bad. I didn't want to do it. My inclination was that I knew that the establishment and the pharmaceutical industry was saying this isn't a problem. But my inclination, I had worked on the Hudson with fishermen. And I remember one time these fishermen told me that the old fish were disappearing from Claverack Creek. And because of a new sewage treatment plant that had been collected, I went up to DEC and said, we got to do something because these guys are making a living catching goldfish. There was the biggest goldfish in the world coming from the Hudson. And they had a market for them. And DEC told me there's no such thing as goldfish in the Hudson. And I was like, yeah, there are. You can go see them in their aquariums. And they have all, they're catching thousands of them. And that happened to me many, many times where the experts would tell me things that I knew weren't true from just talking to normal people. So when these mothers came to me, my inclination was to at least not disbelieve them, but to listen to them. But I didn't want to get involved in their issue. I had the whole issue of intellectual disabilities in my DNA. My aunt, Judith Shriver, who was my godmother, started Special Olympics. I've been working at Special Olympics since I was 8 years old as a counselor and a hugger. My family wrote many of the laws that changed the lives for people with intellectual disabilities. I worked for 200 hours as a teenager at Wasaga Home for the Retarded. It had been part of my life, but that's not what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to do water, fisheries, and energy. I didn't want to get dragged into this. One of these women came to my house in 2005. She found my house on the Cape. She was a psychologist from Minnesota. Her name is Dr. Sarah Bridges. She had a son who was injured, who got autism from a vaccine. He got the award, $20 million from the vaccine court that recognized it. Yeah, he got it from the vaccine. She didn't want to have another kid. She came to my house. She had a pile of scientific studies 18 inches deep. And she put it on my front stoop. Then she knocked on the door and said, I'm not leaving here till you read these. And I am very comfortable reading science. I wanted to be a scientist when I was a kid. All my litigation, virtually every case I've ever bought, involves some kind of scientific controversy. And in order to be able to do my job well, I have to be able to read science critically. And I enjoyed reading it, and I sat down and I started reading not the whole studies, but the abstracts. And before I was 6 inches down in that pile, I realized there was this huge dissonance, a giant delta between what we were being told by the public health agencies about what the science said and what the actual peer-reviewed published science said. So I started doing what I always did when I encountered a problem that I didn't understand, a scientific problem. I started calling the regulators. I called Fred Collins from NIH. I could get him all on the phone. My uncle Ted Kennedy was the chair of the health committee for 50 years, and he was writing their budgets. And you know, doing what they wanted to do. So I was able to get them, and I talked to Kathleen Stratton from the Institute of Medicine. I talked to Marie McCormick, who's the chair of the Institute of Medicine, and I said, just help me understand this, because I'm reading something that doesn't make any sense from what the public health authorities are saying. And I could tell during those conversations, they sent me to talk to Paul Offit. All three of those people said, I can't answer your question, which was weird. And they said, call Paul Offit. Well, Paul Offit was an industry vaccine developer who had gotten $186 million from Merck. And it's like, for me, you know, if I called an EPA official and said, I don't understand this, he wouldn't say, well, call the coal industry lobbyist. That's what it was like. And then I kind of realized these agencies are captured. FDA gets more than half of its budget from pharmaceutical companies. CDC's has a $12 billion budget. Half of that goes to buying and selling vaccines and distributing vaccines. NIH is basically just an arm, an incubator for pharmaceutical products. And they own them. I mean, I got deplatformed for saying NIH owns half the Moderna vaccine. This week, they announced that Moderna is giving $400 million to NIH to pay the first tranche of royalties. So I realized that, and then I started looking at it, and I realized they were either not conversant with the science, they hadn't read it, and it, in the case of Paul Offit, they were actually, he lied to me, and I caught him in the lie, and he knew I caught him in the lie, and I didn't. I'm not gonna go into that, because I gotta get through this talk really quick, and if you wanna know what it was, I'll tell you later. But anyway, I started looking at the vaccine program. And I took, when I was a kid, I got three vaccines. My children got 72. Well, 72 doses of 16 vaccines, mandatory. In California, you gotta get them all. And the change happened in 1989. And the reason the change happened is in 1986, they passed a law which Reagan signed called the Vaccine Act that gave complete immunity from liability to the vaccine companies. So no matter how badly you're injured, no matter how reckless their behavior, no matter how negligent they are, no matter how toxic the agreement, you cannot sue them. And when that happened, when they passed that law, it triggered a gold rush, because all of a sudden these companies, and you know, these are the same companies that created the opioid crisis. These are not like good people. You know, here in New Hampshire, you know, how many, they're killing 68,000 kids a year from opioids. All you have to do is look at that movie, Dope Sick, which is on Netflix. I'm sure a lot of you have seen it. And you see how they did it. They captured the agency, they got FDA to green light them to do this stuff, and now they're killing more kids every year, and the Vietnam killed in 20. So I looked at what had happened. They, as soon as they gave them this, what happened is Wyeth went to Reagan. Wyeth was the maker of the DPT vaccine, which was killing a lot of kids, and we discontinued it. But before we did that, they got sued. You could sue them back then. And Wyeth went to Reagan and said, we're paying $20 in downstream liabilities for every dollar we're bringing in sales. And we're going to get out of the business altogether unless you give us complete immunity from liability. And it wasn't Jesse Reagan. My uncle was head of was chair of the health committee at that time. And Reagan said to Wyatt, why don't you just make the vaccine safe? And Wyatt said, they're unavoidably unsafe. And that phrase is in the statute, is in the preamble to the statute, and it's in the Supreme Court case. So I started looking at what had happened after that, and I realized they also had other exemptions that were saving them money. Vaccines are the only product that does it, medical product that never has to be safety tested prior to licensure. Why is that? That sounds crazy. It sounds insane, but it's true, and the reason for that is it's an artifact of CDC's legacy as the public health service, which is a uniform military, one of the five uniform military services. So the public health service launched the vaccine program as a national security defense against biological attacks on our country. They wanted to make sure if the Russians attacked us with anthrax or some other biological agent, we could quickly formulate a vaccine and distribute it to deploy it to 200 million American civilians with no regulatory impediments. They said, if we call it a medicine, we're gonna have to do 5-year safety studies because a lot of the injuries you get from medicines have long incubation periods or long diagnostic horizons, and you don't see them. And they said, we can't afford to do that. So what we'll do is we'll call them biologics, and then we'll exempt biologics from pre-licensing safety. Testing. Well, so for many years, I've been saying there's not one of these vaccines of the 72 that have ever been safety tested prior to licensing. Tony Fauci was saying he's not telling the truth. He's lying about that. And in 2016, President Trump asked me to serve on a vaccine safety commission. And he made Fauci meet with me with White House counsel there. And I said, Tony, you have been saying that you've done safety testing on some of these vaccines. Can you tell or show me one where there's a placebo-controlled pre-licensing safety trial? And he said, I can't right now, but I'll send it to you.
Oh, yeah.
And he did it. So I sued him. And after a year of litigation on the courthouse steps after sandbagging, HHS gave me a letter saying, you can go look at it on my website, that said there has never been a single pre-licensing safety study for any of these vaccines. So that saves them a lot of money. They don't have to, that saves them about $250 million. Then they don't have to, then they have no downstream liability, which is the biggest cost for every medicine. Then they don't have any advertising or marketing costs because the federal government is gonna order 78 million kids to take that shot. Mm-hmm. So this is like the ideal product. So there was a gold rush. And that's why they added all these to the schedule. And just briefly, what we saw then, beginning in 1989, was a tsunami of chronic disease in American children. But prior to that, prior to the 70s, the chronic disease rate in Americans was 6%. By 1990, it was 11.8%. It had doubled. By 2004, it had gone to 64%. So 64% of our kids have permanent disabilities from chronic disease. What do I mean by chronic disease? And you guys who are my age, you think about this. I'm gonna name these diseases, and you think about whether you saw any of these diseases prior to 1989. Some of them existed, but they weren't epidemic. Neurological diseases, ADD, ADHD, speech delay, language delay, tics, Tourette syndrome, narcolepsy, ASD, autism. Autism went, according to CDC, from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in every 34 kids today. One in every 22 boys. This is what CDC says. Allergic diseases. Food allergy. I had 11 siblings and about 70 first cousins. None of them had peanut allergies. I have seven kids. Why do five of them have food allergies? You know, it has to make you think. So, food, peanut allergies, anaphylaxis, eczema. I never heard of eczema. And now you can't go into a classroom where you don't see it. And then asthma and anaphylaxis. And then the biggest category is autoimmune diseases. So juvenile diabetes, I didn't know anybody with diabetes when I was a kid. And now there's needles in every single classroom. Juvenile diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, all these other autoimmune diseases. We now know that obesity is an autoimmune disease. Oh, and of course, vaccines are meant to hyperactivate your immune system so that obviously it starts attacking your own organs. That's what autoimmunity is. So now, here's the thing, is that all of these diseases I mentioned, there's about 175 diseases that went epidemic beginning in 1989. Incidentally, see, Congress said to EPA, tell us what year the autism epidemic began. EPA is a captured agency, but it's captured by oil and chemical and pesticides, not by pharma, because it doesn't regulate pharma. So it actually came and did some real science, and it came back and said it's a red line, 1989. That's when it started. So that's the year that we started blowing up the vaccine schedule. Now, all of those 175 diseases that suddenly became chronic in 89, all of those, every one of them, is listed on the manufacturer's inserts of those 72 vaccines as a adverse event, as a side effect of the vaccine. So, but that doesn't mean they're all caused by that. Oh, and by the way, the only place that the vaccine companies tell the truth is on that manufacturer's insert. Why is that? Because the only way you can sue them under the Vaccine Act is if they lie, if they know of an adverse event and they fail to list it. So they list them all, including autism. Although publicly they'll say we have nothing to do with them. The other thing is that the federal law says they're not allowed to list them until the CDC, until the FDA agrees that it probably is caused by the vaccine. But it doesn't mean it is. Correlation is not causation. I've done a book that shows, called Thimerosal at the Science Week, that shows hundreds of studies that further indicate that these are being caused by the vaccine. But it doesn't mean it necessarily is true. And by the way, there are many, many other things that could be causing or contributing to this. There's a scientist who's probably the best toxicologist, most famous in this country, Phil Landrick at Mount Sinai in New York. And I've used him as an expert in many of my cases. And Phil Landrick did a study where he said there are 11 things. You have to look at the timeline because it blew up in 89. It affects every demographic from, you have to think of an environmental, by the way, it has to be an environmental exposure that's causing these. Because genes do not cause epidemics. So we know there's some environmental exposure that's causing these things. I suspect that vaccines are the biggest cause. But there could be others, or maybe I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, let's see the data. But what Phil Landrigan said, okay, we gotta take all of these, We got to figure out something that began in 89. It affected every demographic, from Cubans in Biscayne Bay to Inuit in Homer, Alaska. It affects boys at about 3-to-1 rate to girls, and you know, it's some toxic exposure. He came down with 11 things: cell phones, ultrasound, glyphosate from Roundup, neonicotinoid pesticides, and a bunch of others. So there's, but he said there's only 11. It's got to be one of these. Now, wouldn't you think that NIH would say, hey, we got it narrowed down to 11 things, let's figure out what it is so we can make sure it doesn't happen. They've never done those studies, and they won't let anybody else do them, because NIH is a captive agency. And they have taken that $42 billion budget, and they use it to incubate new drugs for the pharmaceutical industry to treat these chronic diseases. And then they collect royalties on them. Not only does the agency collect the royalties, but individual scientists who worked on each project get to collect $150,000 a year for life. So if they're supposed to be regulating us, but they're making money on these drugs. Now, here's where I'm going with this. My whole career has been about fighting agency capture. The USDA is a captive agency. I have sued Smithfield dozens of times, Tyson's, Bo Pilgrim, Monsanto. I was on the trial team. We won the biggest judgment, $3.3 billion. We won $287 million in one suit, $87 million in another, $3.3 million, and then we settled for $13 billion, and now they've taken glyphosate off the market for home gardeners. And we're trying to get it out altogether. But that agency, USDA, is run by these companies. And, you know, I'm going out to East Palestine tonight. And why did that real wreck happen? Because DOT is a captive agency. It waived all of the safety rules because the railroad made them do it. Because they're not working for us, they're working for the railroad. And, you know, and even companies like, even the CIA and the Pentagon are captive by their contractors. And their function is to provide this kind of constant, you know, pipeline of wars to feed that military industrial complex. It's exactly what Eisenhower warned us. 3 days, I went to my uncle's inaugural on January 21st, 1961. And 3 days earlier, on the 17th, which was my birthday, I was 7 years old, and Eisenhower gave this famous speech in which he warned about the subversion of democracy by the military industrial complex. And he said, in that speech, go back and look at it, this includes the federal scientific agencies, which are going to distort science on behalf of the industry. And we are going to become slaves to that knowledge monopoly that they have. Oh, he warned us that all this would happen. Now, if you're looking at what, I'm not going to talk about what happened in the pandemic, which I could talk about quite a lot, you can believe. I just talk about the response. If you're a Republican and you are skeptical, and by the way, it was Biden and Trump who did the response, so it's not a Republican or Democratic issue, but it tends to be the Republicans are more skeptical of it than the Democrats. And the Democrats were more likely to buckle under and say, we all got to pull together, we're all in this together, and you know, we need to do what the government is advising us to do. But if you're skeptical of that, and who can blame somebody for being skeptical? If you're skeptical and you see what happened, you see the lockdowns, which from the beginning, the lockdown, you know, WHO recommended against mass lockdowns. CDC had, you know, their own guidelines that you never lock down the public. This was known. There's so much literature on there. Hey, you quarantine the sick, you protect the vulnerable, but you keep the economy going because you're going to kill more people with lockdowns than you will with from the disease. And that's exactly what happened, and it was a war on the poor. Mm-hmm. Brown University just did a study that showed that toddlers in our country lost 22 IQ points. The children are not making their milestones. 30% of children are going to need remedial reading throughout their entire academic careers at the end of high school. How does CDC respond to this? by rewriting the childhood milestones. They were the ones who were censoring criticism of the lockdowns that were making them rich. So if you're outside of this system and you're looking in, it looks crooked. And you can't be blamed for thinking that. And there was assault on the Constitution. We started censoring people. The White House ordered Facebook to censor me. Adam Schiff sent a letter to all of the social media titans and asked them to censor me. Now why? Because they said I was guilty of vaccine misinformation. Well, now we know that the term vaccine misinformation is a euphemism for anything that departs from government orthodoxies or proclamations, whether it's true or not. And I would challenge the White House, and I've said this, or anybody else, to show me one thing I got wrong. I have the biggest fact-checking operation in U.S. journalism today. I have 300 MD physicians, and more than 300, and PhD scientists on our advisory board, including Chris Portier, who's the former head of the National Toxicity Program at NIH, and until his recent death, Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize in 1983 for discovering the HIV virus. So, you know, if I was passing on misinformation, none of these people would stick around. And what I've said is, show me one thing I got wrong. Show it to me. Nobody's been able to. And by the way, if you show it to me, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to change it. Because I don't want to be wrong. But, you know, what they're doing is they use this infrastructure, the control of the media, to shut down censorship. And not just me. I don't care. I don't feel sorry for myself.
Station ID, you're listening to WMRW 94.5 FM, streaming at www.wmrw.org. And this program presents the views of its participants and procedures and does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork. Thank you for listening.
Actors, celebrities, sports figures get silence. This is not America. No. My father said this so often to me that democracy depends on the free flow of information. It is sunlight and water and fertilizer for democracy. Without it, it withers. There's never been a time in history where we look back and say, the guys who were censoring, you know, the guys who were censoring free speech were the good guys. They were never the good guys. Free speech is, you know, the founders realized that democracy is a sloppy, messy, expensive, and inefficient system. But they said the one thing that we have an advantage over totalitarian regimes that can move so much quicker is that we have free flow of information, which is going to assure that the best policies are ones that have triumphed in the marketplace of ideas and annealed in the furnace of debate. And when we shut that down and just impose, censorship doesn't work either. It doesn't make people stop believing what they believe. You only can do that through persuasion. You know, and it's a lazy person's way out. So, and then once you get rid of free speech, Adams and Madison Hamilton said we put freedom of expression in the First Amendment because all the other ones are dependent on it. Once a government has the power to silence its opponent, it has license for every atrocity. And sure enough, what did they do next? They close freedom of religion and worship is also the First Amendment. They close every church in America without any scientific citation, without any public hearing. You know, democracy was excluded. There was no during the Revolutionary War. One of them, a smallpox epidemic, at if we hadn't had it, it froze the armies of New England in Maine, northern Maine, and it otherwise Canada would probably be part of the United States today. Because that, you know, Benedict Arnold's march on Canada was destroyed by the smallpox epidemic and a malaria epidemic that debilitated, that decimated the armies of Virginia. And then between the time that we wrote the Constitution, between the end of the war 9 years before we had the Constitution, there were epidemics in every city that killed tens of thousands of people, smallpox, cholera, everything that you can imagine. So they knew all about them, but they didn't put an exception in the United States Constitution. Oh, and then they went after, so they got rid of the jury trial, so you can't sue anybody who says we're involved in a countermeasure. They got rid of property rights. They closed 3.3 million businesses with no due process, no just compensation. Many of them, 60% of black businesses will never reopen. They got rid of all of our, you know, the prohibitions against against warrantless searches and seizure with all this kind of track and trace surveillance. Maybe some of it was justified. But let's do what we always do, which is to have public hearings, have an environmental impact statement. You can do it in the meantime, but you can then let democracy proceed. And that was not allowed to proceed. Oh, and so if you look at this as an outsider, as somebody who doesn't buy into the orthodoxy, you can see that this feels like an attack on our values, on our America, on the middle class, which is being decimated. And all of these injuries that I speak about to children, there is no bigger issue for our country than that. We are spending $4.3 trillion on our health last year, $4.3 trillion, more than any, far more than any country in the world, and we have the worst health outcomes. We had the worst outcome in COVID. We lost, we have 4.2% of the world's population. We had 17% of the COVID deaths. Why is that? Well, a lot of reasons, but one of them is we have this huge chronic disease burden. It's not helping us fight infectious disease. It is killing us from infectious disease. That's why people were dying. Oh, and we have the worst health outcome. We pay more for medicine, more for pharmaceutical drugs. We consume three times more pharmaceutical drugs than other Western nations. And we are, and we have the worst health outcomes. Why are we consuming that much? One reason is FDA folded in 1997 and let the pharmaceutical companies advertise on TV direct to consumers. There's only one country in the world that allows that, New Zealand. It's almost as screwed up as we are. I got this bizarre friendship with him ever since. He always let me on TV to debate, you know, Sean Hannity and all these on the environment. I was the only guy that they would allow on there, and I was always on Fox because of that. But he said to me, I can't let that on. He said, if any of my hosts let you on to talk about it, I have to fire them. And if I didn't, I hear from Rupert in 10 minutes. And he said, typically the evening news has 22 advertising slots. 17 of those go to pharma. He said, for my evening news shows, 75% of the revenue is coming from pharmaceutical companies. So, you know, that means they can control everything. They control public perception. And meanwhile, we are getting sicker and sicker. And we're getting poorer and poorer. And, you know, we need to start talking honestly about these things if we're going to bridge that gap. And I'm going to just close with a memory of my dad, which somebody asked me the other day about what my most poignant memories were of my father. And I had to think for a while, but sadly, because this happened at his death, it is one of the most poignant, although I have many, many poignant memories. I was 14 years old at the time. And, you know, I was with him when he died in Los Angeles. And then we brought him back to New York on Hubert Humphrey's plane on Air Force Two. And we waked him in St. Patrick's Cathedral. And then the next day, we took him on a train from Penn Station in New York to Union Station in Washington. And that train track, there were 2.5 million people on the train track. That ride, which usually takes about 2.5 hours, took 7 hours. And, you know, I'll never forget the sight on the side of the track where people of every race and color, it was like the cross section of America. that I had seen in all these campaigns following my dad and my uncles through all my life. There were black people in Newark jamming the stations as we went through, singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic in Newark, in Baltimore, in Philadelphia, and in Washington, D.C. And then in the countryside, there was rabbis and priests. I remember seeing six nuns ingrained in my memory in Delaware, standing in a field on the back of a yellow pickup truck, just waving and holding their rosaries at us. There were people holding babies. I saw a little league game where everybody was standing with their hearts on there. All the kids and the coaches with their hands on their hearts. There were hippies with tie-dye. There were military people saluting up and down the track. There were signs that said, "Goodbye, Bobby." And President Johnson met us there. And we went in a convoy up to Arlington. And on our way, we passed the mall. And at that time, just before he died, my father had gotten together with Martin Luther King. And my father told King, if we're going to help poor people, they have to show up. And they have to do a mass protest. And I remember those crowds. 4 years later, I was studying in Boston. And I was reading demographic data. And I saw in that demographic data that the vast majority of those white people who had stood next to the tracks and had voted for my father and supported him strongly, 4 years later, instead of voting for George McGovern, who was aligned with my father very close, they loved each other and aligned with him on every issue, they voted instead for George Wallace, who was antithetical to my father in every respect. And it occurred to me then, and it struck me many times since, that the easiest thing for a political leader to do is to appeal to our darker side. That every nation, like every individual, has a darker side and a lighter side. The easiest thing for a politician to do is to appeal to our greed, to our anger, to our fear, to our xenophobia, our bigotry, all of the alchemies of tribalism, to press those buttons that bring up those tribal, fearful, angry instincts. And that what my father tried to do is much more complicated, but you can do it, which is to make people feel that they're part of a community and that they're on a heroic journey to do something that is going to be great, that's going to be historical, and that we can't advance ourselves as a people by leaving our poor brothers and sisters behind. That the things that define our nation are these communities that we're building, and they're based on the Constitution. But also we need to value and treasure and nurture our Purple Mountains badges, taking the water, the air, the wildlife, the fisheries, the public lands, the things that we share in common. And people respond to that kind of vision. I saw it happen to my father, and we can do it again in this country. Well, thank you very, very much.
That was Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking last Friday at St. Anselm's College at the Institute of Politics, the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. And I was lucky enough to attend, but I want to send a sincere thank you to Karen and Michael Lacobo and to Jennifer Stella for making this presentation possible. I know how difficult it was, all the behind the scenes work that went into this and getting it to us and getting it out on the radio. So thank you very much, all three of you. And that's the end of my show. Next Friday, I have a special guest, Greg Robbins, and more about him probably in Front Porch Forum on Thursday. Thank you all for listening. Have a great weekend and get ready for Weekend Warm Up with Gary Jackson. Bye-bye.
I'm John, John, the great goose is gone, and the fox is on the town, oh. Then Johnny went to the top of the hill, blowed his horn both loud and shrill. The fox, he said, I better flee with my kill, or they'll soon be on my trail, oh, trail, oh, trail, oh. Fox, he said, I better flee with my kill, or they'll soon be on my trail, oh. He ran till he came to his cozy den. There were the little ones, 8, 9, 10. They said, Daddy, better go back again, cause it must be a mighty fine town, oh, town, oh, town, oh. They said, Daddy, better go back again, cause it must be a mighty fine town, oh. Then the fox and his wife, without any strife, cut up the goose with a fork and knife. They never had such a supper in their life, and the little ones chewed on the bones, oh, the bones, oh, the bones, oh. They never had such a supper in their life, and the little ones chewed on the bones.